Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I mean, no one plans to get sick. And yet, here we are. My name is Matthew Zachary. A quarter century ago, I was given 6 months to live with a diagnosis of terminal brain cancer. For more than 15 years, I've been ranting and raving on the air about stupid cancer and now stupid healthcare, and I'm just getting warmed up. So let's all go make healthcare suck less together, because you know what? We're all out of patience. Hey, that's the name of the show. Got a whirlwind show for you today, guys, with my guest, Dr. Robin Schlicher. Lots of throwbacks to my bar mitzvah Hebrew school day there. She's the Vice President of Business Development at Pear Bio. But there's a whole lot more to this because she's got an incredible backstory, the least of which being her diagnosis in the autism spectrum and how she's managed to live her life in a way that's euphoric and depressive, but energetic and exciting. Out of the gate, you're going to know right away what she's about, what she stands for, and she talks really fast like a New Yorker, so prepare yourself for some quick listening. Her whole shtick is the idea of ending the spread of cancer, because what she does is help doctors and pharma companies evaluate cancer drug efficacy. What that means is, sir, this steak, I asked for medium well, but it's medium rare. Send it back and bring it back. That's kind of the gist of what they do, but they use something called organ on a chip. It's crazy. It's like James Cameron Terminator stuff, but it works to actually help medicine do what it's supposed to do, which is help the people it's supposed to help. She's exciting. She's adorable. She's frenetic. She's invigorated. And she's here in the studio for added chemistry. Please enjoy this incredibly fabulous conversation with Dr. Robin Schlicher. Now, I'm Jewish, and I'm struggling with your last name, which sounds like it is Jewish, but I know it's not Jewish, or is it Jewish?
That is actually
Schlicher.
It's often pronounced as Schlicker, but it's a funny thing because it's actually misspelled. So when my ancestor came over, and I had to study this genealogically to understand what the problem is, because when I was going to Germany to work for a German company, people would look at it and be like, "You don't say your name right." So we would say Schlicker, but in German, it's actually more like Schlicher. There should be a K there.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. Okay. And so when I looked into my genealogy, I found that when they brought them in through Ellis Island, they said S-L-I-C-K-E-R. And then whenever my ancestor, the next generation, tried to go back to being German, right, they misspelled it, is my best assumption. So whenever I'd go to Germany, I'd say my name wrong. And so I finally, like, you know, being a researcher, I looked into it.
Right.
So the question is, do I say my name wrong or spell my name wrong? And I think the actual answer is we spell it wrong.
Well, I my family has that same Ellis Island oops etymology story. My mother's mother came over here as a Hanna Gittel Begunski. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. You're Ida Banner. Yeah, good luck with that, Ida Banner.
Yeah, exactly. But it was great to find the record, because, you know, my father had always said Schlicker, and there's a CH in there. You know, I've learned enough German through the years, and I'd go to Germany and they'd say, "How are you? Why are you saying your name this way?"
And so you've gotten like you probably gotten Schlicker and all. I mean, every possible wrong permutation spoken.
People love to put a T in there, Schlicker, and they really spit that T. The funny part with that is, like, I could always tell it was me because they'd start to sound like a leaking balloon. So they'd be doing roll call and I'd hear, "Shh." I'm like, it's me.
That's you.
Me, just don't worry about it, just call me Robin.
SCH, that's it, you're done.
Yeah, my yep. Brother and I would go by Schlick, so he was like our email. I was Dr. Schlick.
Nice.
For a while, because it's, again, the etiology is going through the explanation on do I spell it wrong or say it not wrong became later in my life, but it was definitely it's always been an issue, like, how do you say that name,
right?
And, you know, I don't really identify with that name very much.
All right, my next question is, you are Robin with a Y.
Yes.
How many times in your childhood were you at a a tchotchke store that has the license plates of all the kids, and there's never a Robin with a Y.
I don't think I've ever seen a Robin with a Y. And my middle name is actually with a Y as well. So I used to think that if I found a man whose last name ended in Y, and I was just screwed.
You're done.
It's done.
That's it.
You know? But that's what happens when your mom is like 19 and just the cutesy, you know, R-O-B-Y-N, K-H-E-H-R-Y-N. And I'm like,
right.
Why?
Is there a reason they gave you Robin? Ever get that answer? I mean, who asked their parents, why'd you name me this? But did you do that?
You've met me, right? So you know I did.
This is for the listeners. They don't know who you are yet. They're getting to know you.
So my name was actually supposed to be Alicia, which I think would just sound terrible with Schlicker. My
Alicia Schlicker.
I know, right? And people would be like, maybe Alicia Schlicker, you know?
Just imagine if you had a lateral lisp.
I know. It would just have been too much because nobody would say either of my names correctly then. But my mother said that I looked like a baby bird when I was born. I was a very okay. pretty baby. You look like a baby bird. And then the whole rhyming the middle name with it came because my aunt is Catherine. So she'd always intended to name me for my aunt. And then it became cutesy to do the YNYN thing.
Fancy.
Yeah.
Very fancy.
It Thanks. Looks fancy.
Thank you, Robin's mom.
She's a character all on her own.
So we were talking before the show that you're the Army brat without the Army. You started in Oklahoma? Is that where you were born and raised?
So actually, it's Air Force brat.
Okay. Is it our Air Force brat?
Yeah. So both of my...
I've been militarily corrected.
My family, you know, again, I looked into genealogy. My family's pretty much been in combat since the inception of the country and often on both sides. So part of my family's Native American. And I think one of them helped disappear, one of Andrew Jackson's generals kind of thing. But now, the story is that one of them was working for Andrew Jackson and the Indians disappeared him in a swamp. And I should be correct and say Native Americans, but in that part of history it was the French and Indian
right.
War.
Are they going to rename the French and Indian War the French and Native American War?
Well, I mean, I'm really mindful of how we talk about
people. I agree. But you think about like these things have been institutionalized across hundreds of years of scholarship.
Yeah, yeah. And yet you still go back and you say, well, okay, But I have an ancestor that was reporting to Andrew Jackson, who was, in my opinion, the worst president outside of recent events.
He was pretty tough.
And
deserve the 20.
The natives had gotten tired of his shit and disappeared him in a swamp. And then we kind of ended up in Oklahoma on my mother's side because of being Cherokee Trail of Tears kind of thing is the family tale. And I have, being who I am with genetics, looked into that a bit and looked into it genealogically and did find, you know, the full blood female.
Yeah, what's
Cherokee.
The pie chart? What's the pie chart?
The pie chart is really crazy. So everybody in my family is actually multiracial through other means. So my father is German and his mother is Filipino, but her great-grandfather, I believe great-grandfather, is Castilian Spanish. So she was a De La Cruz. So if you look at how the Philippines were kind of conquered by the Spaniards, that's all in my genealogy too. But my grandparents met because of World War II. So I'm actually a product of World War II on both sides. My grandfather met my grandmother in the Philippines after the fall of Manila when the Japanese came in and took the city. And the story is that she was, you know, living in a cave being a fishmonger when before that she'd been a nursing student.
Wait, so you're like just basically a genetic potluck.
Oh, totally. Like, you know, there's genocide on both sides of my family. So my father was German and his father was also, I believe, part Irish. And that's where I saw like the S-L-I-C-K-E-R coming in and there was right. some Irish in there. And then my mother's side traces back through some Native Americans like. Her grandparents are actually, her parents were also Air Force. So my parents met on an Air Force base. And my grandparents on that side are actually buried in what's called Marble City in Oklahoma. And Marble City historically was a place where they kind of asked the white people to leave so they could bring in the Native Americans. And some of my ancestors are actually at like the original Cherokee Mission. There's some thought that maybe they
were.
What
do you identify as?
I identify as not white. But, you know, that's a complex thing in this country, because if you could see me, you'd see a you know, redhead with freckles.
But you look white.
Exactly. But that creates a lot of interesting conversations, too, because, you know, I was raised in poverty with siblings that don't look white and a father who obviously didn't look white. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think of that Steve Martin movie, The Jerk, where I was raised a poor, you know,
yeah, right.
you don't look at yourself.
I was raised a poor black man.
Right? Your culture and your perception are where you're raised at. So,
right.
So you know, the people around us could see my siblings and know that there was something different about me.
By the way, the best visual gag in The Jerk is at the end when he makes all the money and he buys a new house, but it's the same house, just twice as big.
Exactly. But, you know, There's some interesting things happening with that lately. If you look at former enslaved people have been accidentally buying the homes of the places where their ancestors were enslaved. So I don't know if it was like a gag or if it's really like an interesting sort of view to the future.
Because, right.
You know, going back and owning the property where things weren't so great, but making it better, I think that's admirable.
So you're a PhD. We're going to get to that in a second. But I always ask PhDs the following question, like endlessly. If you're on the show, you get the question. How many times have you been on an airplane when someone said, is there a doctor in the house? And me, no, not that kind of doctor.
So one of the ironies of that is that my mother was trained as a paramedic and her wife was also a paramedic. So I have actually assisted a few times, like me and an army medic. Actually, there was a young man who had a seizure. And so I was able to help him a bit. But yeah, it's only once in a while that you hear, is there even a doctor in the house? And usually there's like a physician and I'm there to say, well, you know, if you need somebody to give you an opinion about how we could diagnose him genetically,
right.
We can look hysterical. Into that for you, you know.
I saw on your LinkedIn, which is phenomenal and extensive and incredible, and we'll put a link obviously in the show notes that people can, how the hell can something be this lengthy and credible and amazing? Ithaca College.
Oh, yeah. So that they solicited me to ask to help them with their customer experience.
Did you go up there or is it down here?
I actually been doing it remotely. So it's, you know, because I am part of, you know, this Z school to participate in giving them input about how to create programs to make better customer experience, like experts kind of thing. And customer, I think it's interesting we talk about the term customer because you usually think about like consumer.
Like patient versus customer versus consumer.
Yeah, like anybody can be your customer when you're trying to be in service to them.
Right.
So it was interesting to them that I have a big background in serving patients and physicians and things like that. So
I asked because for me, Ithaca is a trigger word, a good one, because I went to Binghamton and spent so much time in Ithaca. And I typically try to do some Wegmans joke in here, if you know what Wegmans is. Wegmans
I've been here more than 15 minutes, so I've seen a Wegmans.
That's it. You can't miss a Wegmans.
But the interesting thing about that is I was actually asked to maybe switch over and do more of a focus. I was telling you about how I went to Mankato for art school. And so I'm potentially going to support a program that is more focused on empowering women. So
I was just in Minneapolis, by the way.
Yeah, I love Minneapolis.
It's a great city. It's a little flat. it's like a nicer Binghamton, I would say. I'm not really trying to put any shade on our land of Great Lakes, whatever it is, the Thousand Lakes, whatever it is. Anything west of Jersey for me is like Europe. I don't care. But at this point, it was a nice trip. I think it's a great state, and it's a fine city. But you went to art school there.
So I actually love to quote Prince when you talk about Minnesota. You know, why is he in Minnesota? And he's like, it's so cold, it keeps the bad people out. But
well, it was 82 when I was there, so I think climate change is deriding Prince's intentions.
You were there in the 6 weeks of summer.
That's true.
So I actually had an aunt who, she was an expert in plastics, and she had me come up there. She also was a chemical engineer, and I did an internship with her. But there was one summer where it just wasn't really working out for me to intern with her. But I had always had an interest in art, and so I went to Mankato State and asked if I could join their art program. And they were, within like one, I'm actually a very talented artist, so they were so excited by my work and life drawing that they actually asked me to stay.
But you say artist, is it canvas, charcoal, sculpture?
So I'm mostly an expert in pastels and charcoals, sketch artists, life drawing. But I have done some forays into actual painting and oils, but it always looks like my pastel work, which I've been told by artists is actually really hard to do.
So how well was DiCaprio's realism on the Titanic?
I think if I were to draw Kate Winslet, I would probably draw her from a different perspective. But he wasn't actually drawing. You could tell.
That I mean, Cameron was trying, I guess, maybe. Yeah. If you give him that kind of direction.
Yeah.
They should have had you on set guiding Leo.
Perhaps, but he wasn't actually drawing when they showed the drawing. Like, so the person, the artist drawing.
Well, it was from the back, right? Someone else was spinning their arms around.
Right, right. So, yeah, I mean, the way that he sort of started out with some impression of it in the circle, like all that is accurate. Like, the one my expertise is an engineer and as an artist is really doing like measured drawing. And so what he was kind of doing was the perspective to get the measured drawing. When you first see the strokes that he makes, the artist makes.
So you draw the polygons first and sketch around them?
I don't necessarily draw so much structure first. I do more like a contour. But yeah, like it's to really understand measurement in terms of perspective by measuring it against other objects.
Is that your true passion? Your I hate the word safe place, but is that where you go when you need to be somewhere that isn't the world?
Writing is actually what I do.
What do you write?
I write a lot of really bitchy stuff about the patriarchy and healthcare and...
I know not of what you speak. What is this misogyny?
But I write a lot of stuff about recovering from trauma and how to be the person you want to be. Because if there's anything that I can tell people, and maybe we'll get into this a little bit more, like I came from basically nothing. And I have gone back to having nothing a few times. In 2020, I actually thought I was going to die of long haul, and I gave all my money away.
Well, we're going to get to the COVID thing.
So I...
That's a thing.
Right? So I gave all my money away and tried to at least... I read a story about a woman dying of a brain tumor, and she said it was really weird to die with money in the bank. And I was like, that's a very valid point. So I tried to support as many people as I could, and I did it anonymously. What's really great is that...
I didn't get my check. Come on.
What's funny is people were like, why would you do that? And a lovely friend of mine who I think should get more credit than he gets, he's a social worker, and he deals with cases like I grew up in, children of extreme abuse and poverty, and he needed some help. And in return, he sent me this Godzilla bedspread that I will treasure forever. It's worth more.
I might have had that in the 70s.
Right? I'm slightly obsessed with Godzilla. So it was, you know, and it's, I can always make money, but you can't always get a really brightly colored Godzilla bedspread delivered to your door.
But you had a point before. Like, I love the expression, I forget who told it to me, like, I never want to be the richest guy in the cemetery.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the point?
Exactly.
Really?
but yeah, I guess what I was trying to say is, like, what I would tell people is, you know, you can start from way, way back. And you can get wherever you want to be. Like, I used to joke about how, you know, I started out in a trailer in the middle of nowhere in Oklahoma with no electricity half the time. You know, I scratched and clawed my way to air conditioning, and the rest is cake, you know? Like, I think I have a different set point for success than most people.
Well, it's like that that cartoon with just, like, equity, equality, and parity, mm-hmm. where... Just make something yourself. It's a cat poster, right?
Well, and I don't agree with a lot of common things. Like, I got into an argument on social media with people a meme.
Why would you argue with anyone on social media? That is the best cancer prevention ever.
Well, I don't get into deep arguments. I try to get into discourse. So okay. There's this meme that says, and I hate this because, well, I understand it, I don't agree with it. But there's all this thought process that you have to be rich and you have to start from a strong place and everything is locked out. If you're not a trust fund baby, or if you don't have all this backup, you're locked out. And yes, I am the first person to say that society is set up that those people are going to go further. I started so far back that me just like getting up and breathing every day is a success, right? So I am completely cognizant of that. However, I gave the example that, you know, it was about being an entrepreneur, and rich people's kids can be entrepreneurs because they can take those risks. And I called bullshit on that. You know, like, I'm an entrepreneur and I started with nothing, and I'm willing to take risks because I don't mind going back to being impoverished. And the meme was written in such a way that sounded like the poor kids can't ever really achieve. They're just, you know, they're just hanging out at the circus doing all the work. So what? And so people kept trying to school me that I'd missed the point. I'm like, no, I am the point.
Yes.
You know, like,
I represent that.
You know, and the person who originally posted the meme is actually a relatively famous author. So that was part of the reason I was participating in it. And she did actually point out to others that they were missing my point. But then it got to be just too many people trying to school me. And so I just deleted it because I don't have time for that.
Note to self, don't get into arguments on Twitter.
Well, the crazy part is it wasn't intended to be me getting into an argument. It was to me to say, yes, this meme has credibility. I do recognize that the Elon Musks of the world are going to become billionaires more easily than someone like me. But it was to give credibility to the fact that I could, and people like me can actually leave the grind. You take the grind and make the grind into other things.
Right.
I think that there's this thought process sometimes that if you didn't get the good starting block or the pole position, then you can kind of say, I don't have to go further than that. And that's fine. Like, if that's where you want to be, like, I'm never critical of anybody who doesn't want to live the way that I do. Like, not everybody needs to be a workaholic who's, you know, put themselves through the stuff I put myself through. But I think there's a place to support the people who get up every day and do say, I want to see how far I can push this needle. You know, I want to see what I can do.
Wasn't expecting to get into Dickensian philosophy here. But with that, we're going to take a quick break and be right back with Robin with a Y.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
So back in my day, I'm 48, so this is the 70s, you were just crazy, right? Get over it, therapy, fresh air on the roof. Remember those days? Like, we didn't understand mental health and spectrums and these things. And then all of a sudden, autism, bipolar, Asperger's, these things were emerging for all the right scientific reasons. And I found out later in life that I'm bipolar. Like, okay, now what? What do I do with this? I'm already me. Right,
right.
And you mentioned before the show that you have autism. Is that like normal? Is there a normal? Help me understand the spectrum these days.
No, I think that perhaps me saying that is a misnomer. I would say it's more accurate that I'm on the spectrum and neurodivergent would be the better way.
Is that the phrase, neurodivergent?
Neurodivergent.
That's a lot of syllables. It's got to be something simpler than that.
You know, it's, I think that there's a lot of bias about the term autism and its understanding of what it really means.
Right. It's not the umbrella.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that there's a lot of space, you know, the whole big tent nonsense when you talk about some of the political part, but that the neurodivergency is a big tent. There's a lot of different ways in which you can be a little different from your peers or from what is considered standard.
We can't say weird anymore, can we?
I say weird all the time. Like, I'm unbelievably weird. I wear that like a badge. I just don't know.
But it's
know
just
that,
like, whatever happened to just being super geeky, nerdy, dorky, awesome?
Well, I would think that we're both all of those things.
Yeah.
But the important part to talk about with neurodivergency is that it does create extra challenges that most of us have learned to compensate for our entire life. Mm-hmm. And when you find out that it's not just you being weird or crazy, because you write yourself off a lot, like, oh, well, I'm just weird. Oh, well, I'm just... It is actually a difference in the way you perceive things, and it does make things a little harder for you. And so I think it's important not to just have a label to what you are, but to have an understanding of yourself. You know, you're not necessarily going to perceive things in the same way. And, you know, we talk about ADHD superpower is this sort of crazy.
Things I can count toothpicks like Dustin Hoffman.
And I don't like to say that it's all just about having these crazy superpowers, because it's exhausting to live on these high spectrums, as you know, with
bipolar.
Well,
you're either
right?
on or off sometimes.
Exactly.
Too.
You know, the mania is like, everything is amazing. And then you're like, oh my God, I can't get out of bed. Right. So I think that understanding that about yourself and then trying to create ways to communicate with your people around you so that they can help you, they can compensate with you. Because most of the people I know who've lived like this, especially women, because as Wick, we were saying earlier, women don't get, especially, I'm the same age as you, actually. which always kind of surprises people because they seem very young. So women historically didn't get diagnosed with a lot of these things, which is why my diagnosis is potentially very up in the air. Like a lot of this is
how old were you when you got a question, like a formal? Let me say that again. How old were you when you got maybe a quote unquote formal diagnosis?
I didn't really get good input on that until I was in my 30s and 40s, actually. Mm-hmm. So I was accused of a lot of weird things. But I one of the challenges, again, is I come from a lot of trauma and I'm highly, highly intelligent. So my ability to compensate for things was extreme. So I didn't find out until I was in my 20s I even had learning disabilities. And my
you
ability,
just were.
I just was. And you know, coming from a lot of trauma, people wrote off a lot of my behaviors as, well, she's traumatized, or people with PTSD act like that.
Yeah.
And like I said earlier, it even comes down to physiological problems. I'd go to a doctor and say, I'm having this extreme anxiety. My PTSD is well managed. And they'd say, well, but you have PTSD. You're just going to be anxious. And in the end, I
Here's
actually
some
had
Xanax.
Yeah,
and some bourbon.
I actually had anemia. So there was a physiological problem. So I don't know how to really answer that question because it's been a process over 20 years.
Right.
Like my chronic health problem, too, took over 20 years to really understand better because I'm on this weird spectrum of, I don't want to say it's cutting edge, but it's kind of cutting edge. It's things that we're learning as information is coming out about the human experience and about how our genes form us into people with varieties of effects. You know, like I can get really in the weeds with this. So, you know, I have a disorder where I don't potentially methylate properly. So that's
you
part of the reason.
When you, methylate?
So in your cells.
I'm learning today.
All right.
So, methylate.
So in your cells, to do an active form of something like a B vitamin, you have to add a methyl group to it at the cellular level.
And is that like ethyl methyl, like from chemistry?
Kind of, yeah. CH3. Okay. Yeah. So like that. And okay. So you stamp that on there and it helps to activate it. And some of us aren't well capable of doing that. And so I have some problems with processing B vitamins, so I have to take some in an active form. And that's just doing that kind of changes my life because having that kind of anemia is really challenging when you're kind of low in B vitamins.
You're not going to like gnaw on some I-beams on a construction site?
Exactly. But when you actually look at blood level of it, it looks like I'm potentially normal, but I'm not actually activating it properly at the cellular level. And you know, there's some thought that this why I went into this part of the industry, right? Because I needed to understand myself better.
Well, before we get to that, because I want to get to what you're doing, because I was fascinated when we first did on LinkedIn. Do you feel like there's a balance of tolerance between people on the spectrum and people not on the spectrum?
Yeah.
My daughter's very intelligent. She's somewhere, she has most of my brain, like the weirder parts of my brain, but really smart. She sees the world differently and has like this processing calculus about decisions and observations and her proprioception in a very different way. And she can't understand, I mean, she's 12, so
right.
Level set. She can't yet understand how everyone isn't like this.
Right.
Well, why can't they do this? Why can't they see that? There's an over-under on this too, but your career is storied. You've met tons of people. Have you had to develop a tolerance for people that are not in this, what did you call it? Neuroplastic, what was the word?
Neurodivergent.
Neurodivergent space.
Yes.
And vice versa, I suppose too.
I think it comes back to some of my trauma levels and some of my thoughts about myself from growing up. I always knew I was intelligent, but I didn't test as well as a lot of my peers. I always thought that I wasn't as smart as them because I couldn't quite hit the right goal post for National Merit Scholarship. I was always just a little bit under.
Right.
And then when they actually realized the level of learning disability I had, it became I'm astronomically intelligent, actually, but I can't be tested
for all the wrong ways.
Right. I can't really be tested in the same sense because when they were doing IQ tests on me when I was 4 or 5 and I couldn't write it out, they were just asking me questions. They were like, wow, this child is so smart. And then they started putting me in to take like the fill in the bubble test, which I do well enough at. I've always been recognized as intelligent.
Do you ever do the neuro psych test with the little things that have to go in the holes, like a checkerboard?
I've probably once in my life. I've had so much therapy.
Anyone listening that's done a neuropsych test knows exactly what I'm talking about. It just drives you nuts.
I've done many of those types of tests through the years because of my level of trauma. I was one of those people that, you know, I'm going to dig again. My whole life, my whole career has been finding a solution. So I'm like, I'm going to talk to all these therapists. I'm going to talk to everybody and I'm going to figure out, I'm going to, you know, do everything that I can to try to be well before I realize that wellness itself is a spectrum.
Well, actually, that's a good segue too. You're working for a company now called Pear Bio, not a sponsor. I have to disclaim that. I just was fascinated within the bouillabaisse that is my brain churning every day on this idea of ending the spread of cancer. I come from advertising. I get slogans. I know like nice little hooks here and there. But you chose to work there. Why?
In part because it circles back to something I've been thinking about for a very long time. So I was a grad student, and let's go back to this first part of the story then. So I was, 5 years old, and people were like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And there wasn't language for it. I had a vision of the future where I could be not quite a physician, but other than that. And so I predate bioengineering, and I wanted to basically be what became bioengineering. So I started taking engineering classes. I went to molecular biology, and I tell people in medical school, you should study molecular biology. And the irony of it is they're like, oh, I guess you were right about that, because, look at the future that we're in.
Early trendsetting.
I know. Well, that's exactly what happened with ParBio. So I was working in a laboratory at Georgia Tech, and we were working with Emory Hospital on cancer, and I was working with cancer cells. And I was supposed to be doing flow cytometry, and I fell into this microscope.
Wait, you keep throwing syllables here. Photocytometry.
Flow cytometry.
Okay. All right.
So it's when you look at
slow down there, Tex.
that is a per cell way of looking at cell outcomes. So anybody who's worked in blood will understand. Like you take cells and you run them through a tube and you hit them with a laser.
And that's what those syllables mean.
Yeah. Yeah. Flow cytometry.
Perfect.
Right? It's counting through.
I'm going to hit the jargon button, but that's okay. It's a medical jargon button. It's a good button to hit.
Yeah, exactly. So I fell down a hole doing microscopy, and a lot of people who become like microscope jockeys will tell you that it's just very addictive. And so I was working with a man named Robert Epkarian in electron microscopy, and he was a really amazing person. He had died on a motorcycle at 22 and then came back to life.
What?
Exactly. These were the kind of stories.
Zombie doctor.
Exactly. So he took an early interest in trying to help me get through some problems, because as I told you earlier, I actually failed out of the PhD program I had first joined. And trying to recover myself from that, I ended up going into microscopy. And what he taught me about EM, these were the early days when confocal microscopy started coming in. We'll talk about what that means, if that will help you. So electron microscopy uses electron beams to look at very highly resolved images, but you have to really affect the cells a lot.
Is this new tech, or is this?
This is very old. So electron microscopy is very old technology, and you can fix the cells, and you slice them apart, and you stain them with heavy metals, and you look at them. So you really look down in the cells. So if you looked at pictures in books of cells like mitochondria, nucleus,
the powerhouse of the cell,
right? So those
AP Bio.
Yeah. So if you see these grayscale pictures back in the day, most of them were probably done with electron microscopy.
Do they still have that? What's that? Endoplasmic reticulum?
Yes.
Yeah, remember something?
Cells still have endoplasmic reticulum.
You just jargon some jargon to my.
You're learning.
The space where the tumor was is filled with AP Bio books.
So there was this kind of newer technology, this confocal microscopy, where you could do what was called optical sectioning. So you didn't have to actually cut the cells. You could use light paths to look through cells and then create three-dimensional stacks of it. So you could set the microscope to capture different planes of focus and then recombine it in three dimensions.
All right, let's unnerd this for a second. How does this apply to cancer?
So what I thought about when I was younger is if you look at the cells at this level and you treat them with chemotherapy or other drugs, or what I was doing was a mechanical means, and understand how to affect them intracellularly to cause death, then you could potentially create a way to do targeted chemotherapeutics or targeted ways to kill just cancer cells.
Right.
One of the challenges, as you know, with chemotherapy is it goes all through your body and it makes you very, very ill.
Napalm.
Right. And so my first work with Dr. Mark Palznitz was trying to understand how to target these systems better to try to just get the drugs or therapies to the cells that it needed to be in. And I thought there was a way to do that looking at the cells themselves. So I'm looking in three-dimensional analysis, doing Z-sacs on a confocal, and also comparing that to flow cytometry. And this was some work that actually kind of became famous. So I got a big press release on this stuff using EM and comparing it to confocal, and that was kind of groundbreaking at the time.
Now, so this is applicable today in what specific
manner? So fast forward 20 years to ParBio, where they're basically doing the same thing, but much better than I ever could.
I would hope it'd be better 20 years later.
So
went from like Nintendo Entertainment System to PS6. It's got some improvements there.
So what they do is very similar in some ways. So they take, again, confocal microscopes. They do three-dimensional stacks over the course of days. And then they do computer vision, and they actually look at multiple cells, and they see how the cells change as you expose it to chemotherapy, and we can create algorithms to tell you about the outcomes. Now, the really cool part about that is it's directly on cancer patient cells. So we take cells from a cancer patient.
Cancer cells themselves. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we take cancer cells from a cancer patient. We put it into an organ on a chip. And so we take...
What is an organ? That sounds very James Cameron Terminator. What is that?
So we have what we call chips, which are about the size of a microscope slide. They're these small oblongs, and they're hooked up to a perfusion system, so you can get chemotherapy to kind of perfuse.
So you put
through
a piece of biological tissue on the slide.
Yeah. So we take the cancer cells.
And you beat it with a stick.
We affect them and we put them into these chips.
Okay.
And then we flow chemotherapy through and we look at it. We stain it with fluorescent dyes and we look at it in confocal microscopy. And we measure changes in the cell. And we use computer vision to tell you if your cells are reacting to the chemotherapy.
At the individual level?
At the individual level per patient. And, you know, there's a lot of really great things to think about with that, because if you can directly measure the effect of chemo on a patient's direct cells, then that can help the doctor make some decisions about what the right chemotherapy
is. Right. The one size fits all that I had 26 years ago don't work no more.
Well, and there's been a lot of great advances in that. With liquid biopsy and other ways, we can look at targets, biomarkers. But the challenge with biomarkers is that even when you find a good biomarker, it doesn't necessarily hit every patient because you're still on a spectrum. So even if you have this particular gene, is it necessarily expressing in the right way? So, you know, genomics tells us one thing, you have those genes, and then RNA and expression tells us, are those expressing? But it doesn't always tell you that person is really going to be what's called a responder to therapy.
Right.
And so the next stage is what we're doing now, which is functional precision medicine. So a lot of my career has been in precision medicine, you know, taking medicine precisely to an individual. And now what I'm doing is what's called a functional assay. So we're looking at how the cells themselves function when you expose them to the treatment.
That sounds important.
I would like to think so.
It's nice to know that what you think will work might actually work.
Exactly. And it's really important, particularly in patients that don't have a good biomarker. So our lead indication is things like triple negative breast cancer. So I've spent a lot of time talking to triple negative patients. There's not a good, strong biomarker to really guide that therapy for them. And it's a very challenging, complex disease. And when it recurs, their options are extremely limited. So it's really important to get it right for them.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left and there's a whole lot more to do, but you kind of live here and we're going to probably have you back many, many, many times because my listeners know this. I've been doing this a long time because I was kind of drafted into the cancerverse. But I just find it so fascinating that this tech exists. We are literally at this point where like computers can determine whether you're going to live or die.
Right.
But, you know, solving for X is making sure the patient or the human being on the other end actually knows it exists and can afford it and can get to it and all these other things. But in the brief time we have left for this particular episode, might you proffer up a perspective of hope that this Einsteinian level progress in biotechnology will actually get into the hands of the right people sooner than later?
I'd like to tell you a hopeful story and then tell you how I think this is going to play
out. Okay, let's wrap up with this.
Okay, so yeah, I've been doing this for a very long time. I came from very grim circumstances, but I kept believing in it. I worked the long 120-hour weeks. I traveled 6 days a week. I helped build the industry. I helped build bioengineering, all that kind of stuff. But in the last few years, I kind of gave up on myself. I was like, I can't do this anymore. I got very caught up in corporate structures. And then I came to Pear in part because of the whole opportunity to close that loop on 20 years, but also because that CEO gives me a lot of freedom to do the things that I think are important. And so I had met a triple negative survivor, Saran Rothberg, a few years ago.
I know Saran.
You know Saran, isn't she lovely? So I met her on what was turned out to be one of the worst days of my life at Stanford University. And she remembered me 3 years later and I said, hey, I'm working in triple negative breast cancer. You're this great advocate. Do you remember me? And she said, yes. And she's actually, there's a gala for the triple negative society. I can get you in. So she got me in even though it was sold out. And I went in there and at first it was a lot of very lovely people who were giving a lot of money, right? And so I finally found a cancer patient and I asked her about her experience and she said she was a HER2 patient. And that was actually where I started in industry, was at Abbott Labs on fish probes, supporting HER2, right? So I was out there in the field teaching people how to read HER2. And it was novel. Like I keep telling people, like 10 years ago, this was a novel thought that you could make a better decision about how to treat patients using a probe kind of thing. And that's become standard of care and was basically recognized as the first CDX, first companion diagnostic. And I told her that, and she just got very, wow. And then she points me to another person who says that, you know, they're triple negative, and they get the Signatera test. And Jimmy Lin and I, Ted Fellow Jimmy Lin and I, were some of the first people. I was the first person to go out and talk about it in London from a commercial perspective. So I helped bring Signatera to the market. It didn't even have a name when I first started talking about it.
But that's rewarding.
So I'm standing here in this room of women. A lot of them, you know, would not have made it necessarily without this technology. And every single one of them that I talk to has been affected in some way by work that I contributed to. And things had been really hard for me. And I had really, like I said, I was like, this is my last hurrah. I'm not doing this anymore. And we're all dancing on this dance floor to Gloria Gaynor, I Will Survive. And I'm like, you know what? Fuck all that other stuff. This is what I thought about when I was 5 years old, that one day I'd be in a room full of people who survived because I wasn't a physician. I was more and other than a physician. And how many people get to see that happen in their lifetime?
So. I can't think of a better way to wrap the show with that sentence. Dr. Robin with a Y, Schlicker. I'm just going to go with that. I'm not going to even try to pronounce it all the right ways. You happen to be the vice president of BizDev at Pear Bio, but you are so much more. And I guarantee you, listeners, you will be hearing more from her in the future. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
That's all for now. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe, leave a review on Apple Podcasts, follow us on social, and tell all your friends to listen. Tell us what you'd like Matthew to cover in his next episode by leaving a message for us at 855-AUDIO-66, and we might just use it in a future show. Out of Patients is a product of Offscript Health. We are a healthcare engagement company built for patients and caregivers by patients and caregivers. Our executive producers are Matthew Zachary and Andrew McDowell. Our senior producer is Betsy Shepherd. Our host is Matthew Zachary. It is recorded, mixed, and edited by Betsy Shepherd. For advertising and media inquiries, email media@offscript.com. That's media@offscript.com. For more information, visit offscript.com.